From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Matt Canham is joining us to talk about his in-depth series where he traces the path of a gun that killed a police officer. Though really, this is a profile of a West Jordan police detective as he works through his grief and guilt over the death of that officer. The series is about how first responders face trauma, the toll it takes on their emotional lives, and the struggle to find help. We'll be right back.
On the next More to Say, we're picking up on a conversation we started last week about affordable housing in Utah. This is part of KUER's Hive Mind project, where you ask our reporters questions and they try to find the answers. This time, it's all about tiny homes. Maybe you've seen them on Instagram, those beautifully apportioned, incredibly small houses. People go nuts for this stuff. Things get complicated, though, for one couple when a nosy neighbor spots their tiny home in a friend's backyard. Download the next More to Say, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're a police officer or a first responder, here's the dilemma for you as laid out in Matt Canham's recent six-part series for the Salt Lake Tribune. The longer you stay on the job, the more you're going to see violence and accidents and wounded bodies and dead bodies. And then Canham says over time, these police officers construct this emotional armor to protect themselves. And it's not just about the trauma of being in a dangerous situation. Sometimes there's guilt, too. And all of this leaves these officers feeling, Canham says, a step removed from the people they're supposed to serve and also removed from the people close to them. Matt says that they feel like that the only people they can relate to sometimes or offer solace are their fellow officers. But it's just not easy admitting to a colleague that you're struggling, so they'll hide the pain. And it's driving many of them to the edge. Matt Canham is joining us today to talk about his article and what he's learned about how first responders struggle to find help and some of the methods that are out there that could work. Matt is the senior managing editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. His series is called Officer in Distress. It ran earlier this month. We'll put a link to it on our website. The Tribune, I should mention, is hosting a panel discussing all of this tonight at the Salt Lake City Library. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later in the program. But Matt Canham, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, let's start, I guess, at the beginning of how you started thinking about this. Now, if I get it right, this really began as a kind of a reporting project. You're going to trace a gun.
Right.
That's how it starts?
This had nothing to do with mental health issues. When I first started talking to Detective Brent Jacks, I moved back from Washington, D.C. I was a D.C. correspondent for the Tribune for a time, and I came back to Utah, and I wanted to write a story that was different than something I've done in a while. And I had known Detective Jacks back when I was a young cop reporter. And I reached out to him and said, I want to talk about stolen guns and how they are traced by police, how hard it is, how the laws make it difficult, and how these guns are involved in crime. And I wanted to talk to him because we had worked on a story all the way back in 2004 that I called Diary of a Gun that traced a stolen gun from a Uinta County burglary to the hands of a teenager who killed a cop.
Yeah.
And Detective Jex was one of the investigators that traced that gun. So we met over cheesesteaks. He agreed to talk to me about it, and we set up a series of interviews. And it was in the middle of those interviews where I asked the simple question of how did this case affect you, that I got an answer that I did not anticipate.
Did you have any idea at the time that you talking about this gun was kind of was triggering this horrible incident for Brent Jex?
You know, I don't know why I didn't think about this stuff. I don't know why we as a society don't talk about it more, about how these first responders are human beings and these are very traumatic events in their lives, not just the lives of the people that they serve. It didn't occur to me.
Yeah.
And when I asked how it affected him, and he had this long pause, and he said, well, you know, actually, I've gone to therapy over this one. And there's that moment where, you know, when you talk to law enforcement, they don't open up very often.
Did he feel sheepish about saying that? Did he feel?
No, he's a very matter-of-fact guy. Yeah. But there was a long pause, like he was deciding how much to let me know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he told me, and he said it as a past tense. Hmm. What I didn't know is he was currently going to therapy.
Yeah.
You know, while we were doing those interviews, he was processing how much this case and others affected him then. Yeah. So it was this weird timing where when I called, he had already started therapy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that had to feel weird and out of the blue. 10 years later, a reporter calls about the case that has been haunting you for 10 years.
Yep.
Right when he's seeking therapy. And so as a reporter, there's these moments where you're talking to someone and they say something that feels like just huge news or something that could be amazing. And you have to keep a poker face, you know, that moment where you're like, yeah, that's totally normal. I totally expect this.
Scribble, scribble, scribble on your pad.
This is so what I anticipated. Yep. And so he said that, you know, he's gone to therapy. And so the next obvious question was, well, can we talk about that?
Yep.
And I expected a quick no, and I was going to move on. And he said, sure, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so I just had to keep that poker face like, yeah, this is totally normal that a police officer is talking to me about his about his therapy and how this affected him and letting me in. That's never happened in my career. And he was so upfront about it. And as we had more conversations, he let me talk to his wife about these moments. He let me talk to his therapist and see his therapist's notes about the sessions in which he went to talk about this. He let me talk to his friends and, you know, people in his department. And that level of openness was every time it surprised me.
Yeah. It's interesting how many layers there are in this story. I mean, some of this is about how they process memories.
Right.
Some of this is about the idea of belonging, just their relationship with their that their officers, as I mentioned in an introduction in your piece, you talk about how it's about they don't want to not feel like they belong. The only people they can relate are their colleagues. The layers to the, did you realize how multi-layered this was as you jumped in?
This took me a long time to put together. And so the layers built and I was able to kind of take them as slices. And I think that helped with the piece. But yeah, I mean, I think I needed to learn about police culture to write this story and get a sense of what it was like to live in Detective Jex's head.
Yeah.
What makes Detective Jex a unique figure in Utah law enforcement? He is also the president of the Utah Fraternal Order of Police, which is essentially the police union in the state.
Yep.
And so he has two roles. He is a detective who focuses on narcotics cases right now. So he does his day job. But he also is a protector of police. He is the person who defends his profession with police chiefs, with state lawmakers. And so for him to talk to me was about helping other police officers. And so that explained his motivation and allowed me to have another insight into how they interact. You know, those other officers I talked to would not have talked to me if Detective Jex didn't tell them I was okay. And none of that would have happened if he wouldn't say, yes, you're allowed to tell them the things that we talked about. And it showed the bonds and how they interact in a way that I had never seen before.
Let's talk about Jex, who he is. He worked for an amount of time in the gang unit. He was a narcotics detective. You say matter of fact, kind of a circumspect guy, tough guy.
He's interesting. He's a big guy.
Yeah.
And he started as in patrol like everyone else,
yeah.
But it was immediately interested in gangs. He bought his own Polaroid camera, and when he would arrest people, it would take their own gang mugshots. He tracked down where all the gang houses were in his district in West Jordan and would try to beat the detectives to the case so he could talk to the suspects and get into it. So he became a detective far faster than the average police officer. Gangs were his thing. And, you know, so he got to be in that at a time where there was a significant gang problem in Utah, and he was on a task force that these guys did some pretty gnarly cases.
Yep.
And it wasn't just West Jordan. If you look at the Salt Lake Valley, the boundaries between cities are, you know, they're on a map, but they don't make any sense for law enforcement. So the Metro Gang Unit is the gang unit for the Valley. Then there was also another task force he was on. So he was all over the place.
It's like I'm not sure if this is quite the word to use, but it's like they have these violent experiences, traumatic, dangerous experiences, and then they just sort of set them aside. I repress them is the word that comes to mind for me. And it just fades into the background. They're scars that they don't deal with. And as you write in the piece, Brent Jex, I don't know if he comes to a kind of a tipping point, but these intense emotions start to come out. And they come out at home, naturally, with his wife and his daughter.
And this is a pattern of when I've talked to other law enforcement. You know, they're the culture in law enforcement for male and female officers, people who are out there, is to tough it out.
Yeah.
You see horrible things. You see it month to month, year to year. Tough it out and move on. And at some point, what Detective Jex did is he just didn't talk about it, particularly at home. But he started to get paranoid. He started not to be able to sleep. Horrible nightmares that led to panic attacks. And it distorted his reality to the point that he thought that his wife was preparing to leave him, that he would have these long, essentially daydreams about what his life would devolve to. He thought of himself in a, camper trailer eating top ramen while his wife had a new husband and he had to pay alimony and child support. And he resented her for something she hadn't done yet, wasn't contemplating doing.
Yeah.
He created this whole environment. And it was all just a place for his emotional, angst and frustration and anger to go, when really it was all about the job.
There's a moment when he finally has this conversation with his wife, and it's like a dam breaking, and everything starts kind of flooding out, and she's worried because, he's really laying it out.
Yeah.
Talk about that moment, because this seems to be an important moment for this.
Yeah. What happened was, even though Detective Jex has done lots of undercover work and thought he was really good at acting okay or like a different person, he wasn't that great an actor. And people within the profession knew he was having a problem and started talking to him and saying, you need to do something.
Yeah.
And a bountiful police officer who was also in the Fraternal Order of Police and convinces him it's time to talk to his wife. And he comes up with all this speech about what he's going to say. How he's going to, talk about how he can't sleep and these things, these cases are just weighing him down. And he finally has a conversation with his wife in their bedroom, and he gets two words out and melts down.
Yeah.
Melts down in a way he had never in his life, where he could not speak. The tears were coming so hard that he couldn't compose himself. And while she's panicked, he's also panicked.
Yeah.
That moment where he's in his own head thinking, what is happening to me? And when it gets down to it, the only word he can croak out was Ron.
Ron. Yeah. She says, what's going on? He says, Ron. Explain Ron. Who's Ron?
Officer Ron Wood was a traffic officer back in 2001 who responded to a call of a teenager with a gun. That's not what traffic officers normally do, but he was an officer who tried to help as much as he could, and he was close. So he beat the patrol officer who was supposed to be there, ran into a park, and was shot, and he later died. The teenager who shot Officer Ron Wood, Brent Jex had him in handcuffs a couple days before and made the decision that this kid was okay to let out of handcuffs, that they can continue the conversation without him being detained. That teenager ran away. The next officer who found him was Officer Ron Wood, who died. And so Jex carried that guilt. Officer Ron Wood was someone that Detective Jex, was friends with. They played basketball together. They, knew each other. They didn't hang out all the time together, but they were office friends. And that made it even worse. That idea that, his action led to the death of a friend and colleague, and he just assumed that everyone knew and everyone blamed him.
He has this moment. It's an interesting moment that comes up in the process of this therapy, where he has this encounter with Ron Wood, a in the days before that. Right. Like, what's going on? And he's, yeah, it's just, I'm dealing with this kid. I mean, he has an actual interaction about this actual kid who ends up killing Ron
Wood. So when the kid runs away, Detective Jex goes back to inform a supervisor that they have a kid who he thinks could be violent and they need to try to find him. And on the way into the station, he runs into Officer Ron Wood, who's leaving to go out for his shift. And Ron wants to talk about their next basketball game and asks how he's doing. And Detective Jack says, you know, we're dealing with some troubled kids. But he also says he has to go to some training, going to miss the basketball game. And that was their last conversation, and it's a moment that stuck with Jax.
So interesting that moment did, but because it seemed like so matter of fact. But it was an encounter. But the fact that these things come up, I think, are an interesting part of the therapy, which we'll get to. I want to get to this point before we head to a break. So Brent Jex finally is able to open up with his wife, realize he needs to do something. And the question is what? You know, what do you do? And what's interesting about this part of the story is that, as you write, the obvious option is counseling. But there's such a stigma with that that seemed kind of ridiculous or impossible.
It never even occurred to Jex that it was on the range of possibilities, because he just assumed if you're a police officer who goes to see a therapist, you're done.
Yeah.
You know, no one's going to trust you out there. Everyone's going to know. You're going to get shunted off to desk duty, and no one's going to think that you can actually have their back when a tense moment happens. So he tried everything before that. Before he actually ended up doing that.
There's this you tell about critical incident stress debriefing, which is this – I don't know. It just seems like it's this thing that the officers didn't or maybe don't really take all that seriously. And there's a kind of disdain for it. Like, why do we have to debrief from this? I mean, would you talk about this? Because I thought this was an interesting moment.
Obviously, as I said earlier, that I didn't think enough about the mental health of first responders, but it is something that is obviously been talked about within departments. How they deal with it is in an individual department by department basis. But there is common critical incident stress debriefings. And in this case, it was done in a group, which is, when you think about this, highly unlikely to succeed. If officers are taught, or the culture is, to bury it and to act tough, particularly with your colleague.
Yeah, they're not going to talk about it.
Get it in a group and say, tell me your feelings right after something horrible happened. The chance of them doing that seems so low. And that's what happened in this case. All the officers who were involved in Officer Ron Wood's shooting and death in the investigation, they got into a couple groups where a counselor came in who Detective Jex described as some stereotypical, you know, therapist-type counselor who asked them to explain their roles, and no one was into it. He said that meeting, if it lasted 15 minutes, he would have been surprised. They weren't doing it.
They felt even resentful of it, it seems. That was interesting.
Because it was someone from outside their group.
Yeah.
That they were supposed to open up with. And then they were supposed to open up with, you know, in front of their colleagues. Like, that's just – it didn't work.
This stigma, still there?
It is, and it's multi-layered. One, they're supposed to be tough. Two, there is a practical aspect to this. If you were a police chief and you know that you have an officer who might not be mentally prepared to be out in the public, it is that police chief's responsibility to make sure that officer is not out there. So there is a practical reality of, if you need help, you might be sidelined for a while. And that is something officers want to avoid. And so the idea, particularly with someone like Detective Jex is pushing, is early intervention. Before you get to the point where you might not be safe to be out there, to make it so the stigma breaks down as early as possible, where you talk about things as they come up, you get regular mental health checkups so that you can still be a productive police officer without this point where you get to this danger point where you're not safe to be out there for yourself and for your colleagues and for the public.
It seems like you're going to have to rework an entire culture, though.
It's tough. And as a society, we've talked a lot about that with the military. We haven't talked about it with law enforcement, which is why I think Detective Jex talking to me is a brave step. is it puts it out there in very raw terms, and it's him saying we need to talk about it.
I wanted to ask you about an element of the series that I found really interesting. It's not just about Brent Jecks and how first responders struggle to get over the stigma. There's also a good part of it that really talks about this troubled 17-year-old who shot Ron Wood in the first place.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you about that because his own mental health issues, this it's Justin
Van Roeckel.
Van Roeckel. Explain how that fits into the picture.
When we tried to tell the story, what we wanted to do is take a reader who doesn't have an idea of, you know, what it's like to be in these circumstances and these, you know, out there in the criminal world and what's happening, and let you feel what it feels like and be in the moment as much as you can. And the desperation of this teenager and the investigation and the missed opportunities that led to this officer being shot was something we wanted to help explain. Justin Van Roeckel moves to West Jordan, doesn't have any friends, doesn't have a great home life. And he finds someone who he relates to. And that's Tyler Atwood.
Yeah.
And Tyler and Justin do drugs together and they have an addiction and they need to feed that addiction and they don't have money because they're high school teenagers. And so instead of getting a job, they decide to go and do some robberies.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of teenagers do bad things. And there's a teacher who even talks about that. Like, look, people make horrible mistakes early in life. And one thing that struck me and the editor who helped me on this story is that there are a lot of moments where Justin did things that he should have been punished for. But they all felt like there could be other forks in the road where he could have changed the decisions he made. Mm. And instead, the momentum keeps taking him worse to worse and worse places until when he ends up shooting a police officer.
Yeah. It's interesting. He confides in his psychology teacher.
Right.
Mentions that he's having troubles. And now he exaggerates some of this stuff too, but he seems to be, I don't know, I saw it as he's kind of reaching out for help. And
he
this seemed
help.
Like an opportunity.
And that's how the teacher, Jana White, felt.
Yeah.
Is this student who, I mean, he said horrible things in this 25-minute outpouring of emotion, talked about how he felt like he would turn into a serial killer, how he might shoot up the school, kill himself, kill police officers, how he had already been involved in 4 murders, and, you know, how he overdosed, and all the stuff that's – a lot of it never happened.
Yeah.
But clearly this was a teenager who needed help, and she saw this as an opportunity to get help. And that was the plan. At that point, Justin and Tyler had been involved in a series of robberies. They had used masks that were made famous by the movie Scream, this long, elongated ghoul mask.
Yep.
And they would take, you know, a gun and a knife, and they would go into stores, and they would rob them for money and cigarettes. And they had left evidence. Tyler got cut leaving a McDonald's through a drive-thru window that he had robbed with Justin for the second time in only a few months.
Yeah.
And Detective Jex, who was helping investigate this case, saw a cut on Tyler's wrist when he went to interview him. So they knew that police were getting close.
Yeah. And they had nothing to lose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were – but Justin was starting to get more desperate. So he talked to the teacher about it, which led to a confrontation at the school the next day. Where Detective Jex and another detective named Richard Davis came to talk to Justin Van Roeckel. The plan was to get him into some treatment for his drug addiction, but he wasn't out of the woods on the criminal part of this yet.
Yeah.
But they weren't going to immediately lock him up. And that's where
the story explodes.
That's where it explodes.
Because he takes off running.
Yeah. So Jackson and Davis sit down with him, and Justin felt tricked into being in this interview with detectives. So he shuts down and tries to act tough. They're getting nowhere, so they're going to wait for his dad. They step out of the room. The school resource officer tries to talk to him, and Justin bolts.
Yeah.
So these 3 police officers chase him down into the parking lot, And Jex is the one that grabs him by the shoulder, throws him against the nearby car in the parking lot, puts him in his handcuffs. They talk to him, saying, look, we just want you to talk to your dad. Just calm down. What they don't realize is he also has a horrible relationship with his dad.
Yeah.
His dad is not someone he looks at as an ally and a confidant. And so he doesn't want to see his dad. He doesn't want to be with these police officers. He wants nothing to do with this. And essentially, he acts like he's okay. He says he's going to do what they want.
So, now, I just want to highlight this moment because I think this is important. Because this is where Brent checks, second guesses what he had done.
Yeah.
So he goes over the decisions that he makes with Justin. You know, okay, is this kid dangerous? He's troubled for sure, but I don't think he's dangerous. I don't think he's really going to do anything. So let's see if we can make this play out in another way. They don't put him, you know, they don't – they takes the cuffs off him basically.
Yeah. In the parking lot, the three of them think, you know, talk, and Justin seems to be calming down. So Jex makes a decision to take out the keys, remove his cuffs. While he's putting them back on his belt, the other two officers – start walking Justin back towards the school. When he gets to the door, he opens it and runs. Now, unlike some schools where they have really long hallways where you couldn't really hide if you're running, they have these banks of lockers that are stacked in this open area. It essentially makes a maze in the middle of the school. I've never seen a school like this, but it is perfect for a moment where you can run.
Yeah.
And this kid knows this school, and these officers don't know it as well as this kid does, and so he runs, and they don't catch him.
Yeah. And then a few days later, of course, Ron Wood encounters Justin, and Justin shoots him, and he dies. It's important for you to tell Ron Wood's story as well. Let's talk about him, his relationship with his wife. They're trying to have kids. They've been only married for a year and a half when all of this happens.
He was already thinking about leaving the profession.
Yeah.
You know, Ron came to policing a little bit later. He loved the physical aspects of it. He never lost a foot chase.
Right.
You know, he also was incredibly diligent. He wrote more traffic tickets than the computer system could count. They built a computer system where it could go up to 999 in a year, and he surpassed 2,000 in a year. And what he would do, I actually have, he would record a day's worth of calls just in case someone challenged him. And so he'd pick something and say, okay, I'm going to do people who don't use their blinker. And so it'd just be hours of him pulling people over and saying, oh, you didn't use your blinker. And he was always very professional. It was interesting to listen to, but he was a very diligent traffic cop. And he met online with Lori, who was a Filipina woman who was working in the United Arab Emirates at the time. And, you know, they talked online. He went and visited her. She moved out here. In all those conversations, he never said, I'm a police officer.
Wow.
They talked about family. They talked about their values and the things they wanted to do with their life and the trips they wanted to take. And they felt, you know, a real bond. And I don't know how she never asked what he did, but it was only when she landed in Utah that she found out, and she had family who were law enforcement in the Philippines, and she was like, "Woo, I am not sure I'm okay with this. It's a dangerous profession."
Yeah.
So he had started taking computer classes to follow the career path of his younger brother Marlon, and he was contemplating leaving about a year after. His plan was to stay in about one more year after this happened.
Tell the story, if you would, about when Brent learns of Ron Wood's death. He's in Denver
at a conference. So they had spent the weekend trying to find Justin Van Roekel. He runs away, so they're looking around. They're trying to think, where would he do another burglary or robbery, excuse me, and what stores. And so they're all over the neighborhood looking for him. They don't find him. And at some point, Jex has to go to Denver for a gang training, as interrogation training. So he and another colleague from Murray drive to Denver. First day of this class, he gets a note that he needs to call a supervisor. And he calls a supervisor who straightforward tells him that Officer Ron Wood has been shot in the head. It doesn't look good. And that the person who did it is committed suicide, and they thought it was Tyler Atwood. And he hangs up the call, and Jex feels horrible. He gets a call immediately back to say it's Justin Van Roekel, which immediately puts Jackson to just a blanked out shock. The difference is huge. He didn't have Tyler in handcuffs. He had Justin in handcuffs. This one, the difference is it's his fault. At least that's how he perceived it at the moment. And so he has this long, painful drive back from Denver here where he's just in his head the whole time.
Replaying the incident that night.
What he could have done, how people are going to blame him, how he lost a friend and a colleague, but he's not there to grieve with everybody else. By the time he gets to West Jordan Police Department, he is 100% convinced that everyone knows it's his fault.
Whether they're going to admit it or not, they're not going to say it to his face, but they're going to know this is your fault.
Yeah.
Yeah. You say that Brent's guilt felt so raw that when he hugged Ron Wood's wife, Lori, at the funeral,
at
the graveside, forgive me, he felt physical pain.
Yeah. And it's something that, and as we talked about, there was these moments that stay with him, the last conversation and that hug were two of them. Those moments where he couldn't express his pain. And I interviewed Lori. Lori remembers the moment, but she doesn't blame Detective Jax. She doesn't feel the things he felt in that moment. She felt her own just deep, deep sorrow. This is a man that she loved, still loves, still lives in his house. Even though she's remarried and moved on, she's still part of the Wood family. But that moment meant a lot more to Jax. That was just painful.
Matt Canham is with us. His 6-part series for the Salt Lake Tribune is called Officer in Distress. We'll put a link to it on our website. And I should mention the paper's hosting a panel discussion at the Salt Lake City Library, the downtown library in Salt Lake City, tonight at 7 o'clock. For information about that, just go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
You hear stories on KUER. They make you think and laugh. Sometimes they frustrate you, and sometimes they even make you cry. When that happens, what's the first thing you want to do? Share the story, of course. And thankfully, local stories you hear on the air wind up at KUER.org. You'll find news, podcasts, and all the Radio West you want, plus community events. When you hear a story you love, spread the love at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Matt Canham of the Salt Lake Tribune is with us. We're talking about his 6-part series for the paper called Officer in Distress. We'll put a link to that on our website. The paper is holding a panel discussion about how first responders deal with the emotional scars of their work. It's at the Salt Lake City Library. Again, we'll talk a little bit more about that later on the program. So Brent Jex finally comes to the conclusion that he's got to do something, and he finds a therapist. And I want to talk about Brian Murdoch. And start by mentioning the first day Brent Jex goes to see the therapist, because I don't know if it's funny is exactly the word, but he feels so exposed and so vulnerable that he actually backs into the car spot at the parking lot. I mean, I find that really interesting.
So this is like an office park, nondescript. There's a lot of insurance companies, and there's very few signs. And Brian Murdoch's office was in the middle of it. From the street, you don't know what it is. But Detective Jex wasn't taking any chances. So this is a long parking lot. So he probably parks, I'd say, 20 to 30 yards away from the front door, in a spot where he can see the road. And he has a friend in law enforcement on the phone trying to coax him into going, someone who had already gone to therapy himself.
Like, it's okay, Brent, just
you can
go
do
in
this.
There,
it's going to work out. And so he's like, okay, I got it. So he starts walking to the front door, and he gets halfway to Murdoch's door, and he can't do it. And he turns tail, runs right back to the car, and sits in it. You know, obviously he's not in a police car at this time. It's an unmarked car, you know. And he sits there and calls the guy again who convinces him to do it. And he sits and he times the traffic. He sees the time between red lights, when the cars stack up, when traffic will be the lowest.
Wow.
And he tries to time the walk, to get to the door where it's the least likely that anyone could drive by and see. Now, this driveway, there's bushes and trees near it. The chance of anyone being able to spot him is almost zero. But that's how concerned he was to just get through the front door without anyone knowing he went into a therapist's office.
When he gets in there, his expectations are pretty low. You know, it's going to be a kind of a touchy-feely thing. And he says he just wanted a prescription.
Yeah. Give me a pill. Make me sleep. Let's just get this over with. And he didn't want to talk about his relationship with his mom and dad. He didn't want to lay down and some sort of, you know, like we all see in TV
shows. He had all
shows.
The TV
he
images.
He had all the TV images. Yeah. And that's not what it was.
Yeah. Not at all what it was.
No. Brian Murdoch's office looks like kind of like a den you'd have in your house. He has this odd collection of clocks everywhere that tick really softly. And he has this brown leather couches. And he sits just awkwardly close. And he talks about really practical terms how to deal with this trauma. I had not heard of this type of therapy before, and when Detective Jackson and Brian Murdoch talked to me about it, I thought it sounded ridiculous.
Yep.
And then the more I talked about it, the more I thought, if this ever happened to me, this is what I want. This seems tangible.
All right, let's explain this. This is EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a type of therapy. Walk us through it.
So this is really focused on people who have traumatic instances. So we're talking about rape victims, military first responders, those kind of things. So what they try to do is they unpack the traumatic event itself into its parts. What do you remember? How did you feel about yourself at that moment? Did you have any body sensations? Did you have chills or a pit in your stomach? What word do you associate with that moment? All the stuff, they break it down.
What are the images?
What are the images? Yeah. What do you see in your head? Like, so you have this, you know, this, they take it into parts. And then in this case, he puts vibrating paddles in each of Jex's hands.
This is where it can start to sound ridiculous.
Right. And for a period of time, most likely around 30 seconds, the therapist controls the severity and the longevity of the buzzing. And it bounces back and forth between your right and left hand. And the idea is that it's a way to mimic rapid eye movement when you sleep. And the theory is when you go to deep sleep and you have that rapid eye movement, your brain is processing your day and your memories and putting them in healthy places. But with trauma, that doesn't happen. It sticks and it's painful and it's raw and it feels too real and you don't process it. So sometimes in this therapy, they'll actually move their finger back and forth in front of your eyes to actually make your eyes move back and forth.
Wow.
Sometimes that works with people. Sometimes it doesn't. With Jex, they went with these buzzing paddles. And yes, this is the moment where I'm like, that sounds lame.
Yeah.
And the idea is to let your brain just go.
Yeah.
And then after the buzzing stops, the therapist, Brian, would ask, so what did you think about? And essentially, your brain will move to wherever it does. And in Detective Jex's case, it went to that painful hug that he had with Lori. It went to his last encounter with Ron Wood. It went to where he had handcuffs on Justin Van Roeckel, but not in any linear order. And so you do it again, and you do it again. And until that moment has less power over you, until you can process it. And Jex was a massive skeptic, and it worked instantly for him. Like, there was immediate benefits on day one. And that surprised him and elated him. It was still a long process. It didn't get over it. It's not like he doesn't feel grief. But he could start to sleep again. He could start to realize how he had warped his own reality.
You write that the idea for this is to put the memory in the healthy part of the brain so it is no longer a trigger, no longer frozen in time where it can come back on you. So like you say, that memory is stuck in a place and you need to put it in the right one. And we should also mention that even though it sounds ridiculous and it was seen as gimmicky, it's now a sort of accepted therapy.
And it is widely spread among the first responders who actually do get help. The panel discussion we're having tonight, there's a fire chief and a Salt Lake City police sergeant, both of whom have been diagnosed with PTSD, both of whom had this exact same therapy and swear by it.
One of the things that Brian Murdoch also does in this process, I wanted to ask you about, he takes this moment where he kind of plays devil's advocate with Brent and says, you know, all right, how did you botch this case? And this was interesting because you say Brent starts to see now this case from a different perspective. And he begins to realize, and this seemed like an important insight. For Brent Jacks, it seems like he starts to realize that the details had become irrelevant.
Right. You know, law enforcement, you still have to have, you know, a legal reason to detain someone. You still have to have a case. And the case they had about these robberies was around Tyler Atwood. It's Tyler Atwood's cut they had. They didn't even have Justin Van Roekel's name, really. They started to piece it together at the very end, but they didn't have the evidence to lock him up on those robberies. Now, I guess you could argue that they could try to detain him over the comments he made to the teacher. But through negotiation, they already had a plan there. They were pushing him to counseling and continuing to investigate. So Jex didn't violate their plan. He did what they anticipated they were going to do, and it turned out poorly. He wishes he could take it back. He, you know, he doesn't like how it turned out, but he realizes that there weren't these egregious law enforcement mistakes. He didn't make some boneheaded move that led to this. It just didn't work out.
Yeah. You say this moment was revelatory for him.
Yeah. And it was one of those things where the idea of the power that this had on him, and it's revelatory for him, but also for how he saw the profession.
Yeah.
How warped he could be over it and how that could affect others, how they could just have the wrong take or such a damaged take that it could put them in a place where they're so much more emotionally vulnerable than they actually needed to be.
Another thing that was interesting in this interaction he has with Brian Murdoch is recognizing the differences, but also the similarities, but also the differences in the experiences that first responders have to soldiers. And one of the things that was interesting that you write about is for soldiers, not to at all diminish that experience.
Now, there's some horrible things that happen.
Horrible
in war.
Things. But they get to go home.
Yeah.
And for first responders, the so-called horrific zone, I think is how it's put. You're always in it. You're always
right.
It's in the neighborhood. This stuff that's happening is near where you live. This is where you work.
And that's the difference, I think, with these kind of trauma-related illnesses is that for military, they're acute events. They're horrible events, traumatic one-offs, sometimes multiple, depending on how many tours you served. But for police officers, for firefighters, for dispatchers, they build.
Yep.
And when they drive down their neighborhood, they remember, well, this is where this happened, and this is where this happened. I talked to an officer, a story that did not make the piece, who he wouldn't go down a major road, State Street, because of what happened. So every time he tried to get somewhere, he tried to figure out how to get there without driving on State Street. Wow. This was a police officer. He just couldn't deal with it.
The question is, what do you do with that hypervigilance? I mean, this is who they are. And Murdoch says, and you quote him in the piece, being hypervigilant is counterproductive.
Yeah, and that's the thing. We need them to be vigilant,
yeah.
But not hypervigilant. And where is the line? You know, we have mass shootings. We have bad things that happen in our society. And, you know, we all hope that if something like that happens, there is a police officer there. In Salt Lake City's history, you think about the Trolley Square mass shooting.
Yeah.
There was an off-duty police officer who helped save the day.
Because he had his gun.
He had his gun.
Yeah.
Well, if you hear that as a police officer, why would you ever go anywhere without your gun?
Oh, you ask Jex that.
Any moment. I mean, the idea that it's alarming to him to think that he would go somewhere unarmed, because what if something happens at that moment? But the hard part is that is so emotionally draining for a police officer to game plan every location they go to. How would I get out? Where are the vulnerable points? How do I protect people? What's an acceptable loss because of this environment that I can't get to this area? Like, if you think about that every time you go to a restaurant, every time you go to a store, every time you go to a movie theater, it just gets exhausting.
But what do you do about that? Isn't that baked
part into of the deal,
DNA?
Right? It is. I mean, to this day, Detective Brent Jex is not sitting with his back to a door.
Yep. Right.
Not happening. Yeah. He can't deal with it.
But he said that this insight about it being counterproductive was the most eye-opening thing he had gone through in 17 years.
Because they don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, they talk about the hypervigilance. They lean into it. And the idea of, like, how do we disconnect? How do we keep ourselves in an emotional spot? When Jex talks about it being revelatory, it's that the conversations that should be happening within his profession are not. And he's in a place where he hopes he can start some.
You mentioned a lot of times these conversations have to happen before these traumatic events. What's he doing and what's being done that you're seeing to get these conversations started?
So one thing, he teaches at the police academy and he's working with the people who lead that about how to have a class. You know, police officers have ongoing education about how, you know, what he wants to do is have a class that talks about how your brain responds to trauma. And make it feel more scientific and clinical and reality-based, where it's not you had an emotional, you're just a weak person. It's this is how human beings respond to trauma. And help officers realize they're human beings. That conversation he thinks will help. He also is talking to police chiefs. After this story has been published, he has been contacted by multiple police chiefs about the conversation they have with their own officers, about the peer support they offer, about the therapy that they encourage, that culture can change department by department. And so that's part of it as well.
Brent's response, he also talks about the controversial police shootings that have happened over the past few years. And you mentioned them, Michael Brown in Ferguson and Philando Castile in Minnesota and Stephon Clark in California and any number of them. And Brent talks about how and I'm not sure. I mean, there's a racial component to that, but there's also a component of trauma, I think. And this is something that's really interesting I wanted you to talk about, that he thinks fewer of these kinds of incidents, these impulsive acts, would happen if there were these kinds of conversations going on and these kinds of therapies accepted in these police departments, I guess.
Brent Jex believes that there is a widespread problem in law enforcement. Well, I don't have a number, but if you think about the number of traumatic incidents that happen in a police department in a year and officers see those things, that quite a few of them have repressed these sort of issues. And it means that they might not always be their best self at these horrible moments that they encounter. And Detective Jex would say that means they might not make the right decision. And that could mean they don't pull their gun when they should, or it means they pull their gun when they shouldn't.
Yeah.
And we're not having the best law enforcement outcomes because we have people on the street who feel real fear and don't react to the incident in front of them with the clearest mind.
You tell the story in the series about Ron Wood's brother speaking to the news media after Ron had been killed. This is Marlon. And Marlon said, look, we also grieve for the family of Justin who killed his brother. And they basically forgave him. And it was so interesting that family did, but Brent really can't still in some ways. Would you talk a little bit about that finally? Because he still has to deal with his anger over Justin and over Tyler. And to me, it just revealed how you don't get over this at all in some way.
This family was incredibly gracious to Van Roekel's family. The Woods looked at this as a teenager who was troubled, who made bad decisions, who ended up killing their family member, but that was just a troubled kid, and immediately forgave him.
Yeah.
Detective Jex, he wanted retribution. He wanted someone to pay. And the person who, you know, Justin Van Roekel took his own life. So Tyler Atwood was the person around. And while he didn't shoot Officer Ron Wood, he did have that gun. The same gun was used, and he used it in robberies. And Brent Jex wanted him put away for the rest of Brent Jex's career, for the rest of anyone who was there. He wanted 20, 30 years in prison for this teenager who committed a series of robberies. Now, that's far beyond the norm, and that's not what happened. And I'm actually the one that told Brent Jex that Tyler Atwood was out. And you could tell he was not okay with that when I first told him. It took him a little bit to think about it. And Tyler still spent a dozen years locked up for this. And that's longer still than the norm for a teenager who commits he was convicted of two armed robberies.
And Brent's still working it out.
Brent was working it out, and I think he's got to the point where if he ran into Tyler, he could handle it. But it's taken a lot of conversation to get to that point. And I will note, Tyler Atwood, since he's been out, he's off parole. He's had no problems with law enforcement. It appears that he is leading a productive life. There's no indication there's an issue. He's moved on. And Jex is trying to move on, too.
Matt Canham, he's senior managing editor for Salt Lake Tribune. His series is called Officer in Distress. We'll put a website link to it on our website. And we'll mention tonight at 7 o'clock, the Tribune is hosting a panel discussion about all of this at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. We have links to that information as well on our website, radiowest.org. Matt, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.